That's a good song. You know, and I think you can't help, and I don't think I'm the only one, but you can't help but when you hear that song to kind of reflect on just that amazing message that that song brings. And if, you know, I don't know the whole story. I've heard the story and I don't remember it all, but the idea of when that song was written in this moment of intense peril, you know, and sorrow, and yet even in the midst of that, how great is our God, and it's just fabulous. And so what we're going to see this morning is just, it's going to fit really well with that. And what we're going to find this morning is this idea of all of these predictions, you know, that God had made through the scriptures are going to be found to be true in this man, Jesus, that we've been talking about as Jesus has been on the cross. And it's just remarkable. And what we're going to find is 322 prophecies. We're not covering them all today, but 322 prophecies that Jesus Christ himself fulfilled. They're about Christ and the Christ fulfilling. It's just, when you look at the likelihood of that happening, it's so minuscule. And yet, it's documented. And it happens. And it's just, jaw-dropping is part of it. Awe-inspiring is part of it. Humbling. And all of these things just kind of come together. And you're left with like, how great is our God that he can orchestrate, he can design all of this. And so it leads me to want to begin with this idea of predictions. If you caught the news this morning, and if you're a football fan, NFL overall fan, there was this former Minnesota Viking player, Jerick McKinnon, who was traded, or I should say he was actually a free agent, and then he was picked up by the San Francisco 49ers, and they threw everything that they had, and they really recruited hard to get this one running back, because he was going to make the difference. Their prediction was that this could be the player that they needed to get to the Super Bowl, to get to the playoffs. And guess what? Before the NFL season even started, he tore his ACL and he's out for the season. So that whole prediction, I know, I'm not trying to make light of this poor guy's injury, but this reality, we throw all these predictions out. This is the year for the Vikings. This is the year the Packers will finish last in the division. Whatever your predictions may end up being, there's a reality to, in order for them to come true, it's not super likely. You know, even in something like football, in the NFL, you got what? We got 32 teams. You know, the odds are actually pretty good. You pick 1 in 32, that's not terrible odds to pick whoever's going to win, you know? But yet, how many of us would be right? It'd be very few, because this idea of predictions. Well, I came across some very interesting predictions in the past here that I want to highlight. One, so I shared this in the email that I sent out here this last week, and I have a few others. So there was this prediction, and it said, there is no reason for any individual to have a computer in his home. There's just absolutely no reason. This was a prediction back in 1977 that predicted is like, no one's going to need a computer in their home. And yet, if you look at it, on average, now in the average U.S. household, there's 5.7 computerized devices in the average home. If you have a larger family, that number is probably higher. But you'd be surprised even if you kind of just take into account, let's start counting mentally now. Oh, we got the laptop, we got the desktop, we got this phone, because phones are now computer devices, let's be honest. And you got your iPads, and you have them all synced together. Sometimes even your TVs can be considered devices and computers. So it's remarkable, 5.7. So this guy said, basically, there's no need in the home. And at one point, they said there would be five marketable computers. You know, there would be a market for like 5 computers worldwide. That would be it. And now we have 5.7 per household. Very interesting. What about this one? It says, we don't like their sound. This was a prediction back in 1962. We don't like their sound. And guitar music is on the way out. This is what Decca Recording Company said about the Beatles. They may have some regrets. That prediction might have been just a little bit skewed. What about this one? This device has too many shortcomings to be seriously considered as a means of communication. The device is inherently of no value to us. Western Union internal memo back in 1876. And that, of course, would be the telephone. You have any idea how many telephones have been sold? There it is. 1-800-867-5309. What about this one? Everyone acquainted with the subject will recognize it as a conspicuous failure. Conspicuous failure. Henry Morton said, president of the Stevens Institute of Technology. What was he talking about? Back in 1880? Okay? It's going to be a failure. It's not going to catch on. The light bulb. Do you think it caught on? You know? And it's interesting. You look at these were honest predictions of what would succeed and obviously what would not succeed, and they were totally serious about their predictions. It's just that this is impossible. There's no value to this idea of this light bulb, and yet there you have it. This device won't last because people will soon get tired of staring at a plywood box every night. Daryl Zanuck, movie producer. He was a movie producer, in fact, and he even recognized people are just going to get tired of it. It's not going to last. This plywood box, 20th Century Fox, 1946, and that, of course, is the television. Are you tired of staring at your television? Maybe sometimes, but we still do it, right? Okay. Here's kind of, I think this is my last one. The horse, and I didn't bash away from what this was talking about. It's obviously the automobile, but listen to what he says, okay? In 1903, he says, the horse is here to stay, but the automobile is only a novelty. The automobile is a fad. The president of the Michigan Savings Bank advising Henry Ford's lawyer not to invest in the Ford Motor Company. Okay, I got a hunch that that probably was a bad idea to not invest in the Ford Motor Company at that time. But do you think... This is a picture of the highways in L.A. That's where Marky Boyington is. Remember that. He's probably stuck in traffic somewhere in there right now. And he probably will be for the 2.5 months that he's there. What'd you do on your trip? I was stuck in traffic. All the time. But this idea of predictions, so what we're going to see this morning is these ideas, and we're going to take some time, we're going to look at some of what these predictions were. We're going to look at some Old Testament as well as some New Testament predictions, and all of these predictions that point to Jesus Christ. And I want us to be able to come up with this idea of, okay, all of these predictions were laid out there, and we're going to see them side by side in some cases, and I want us to be able to evaluate, all right, did they come true? And if all of these predictions that we're showing, if they actually came true, then that means something. And we have to take a close look at what that actually means for us. And so just to bring you up to speed as to where we've been, where we're going, we have been taking some time. Jesus has been arrested. He's been on the cross. And so we've been spending a number of weeks with Christ on the cross. And we've looked at the work that he's done on that cross. We looked at this idea of how he brought community, how he brought forgiveness, and we saw him exemplify that as he talked to his mother. We're going to see that passage again this morning as he talked to his mother, as he talked to his beloved disciple John. We saw how he gave forgiveness with the thieves on the cross. One repented and asked for forgiveness. The other mocked him. And we saw what Jesus did in that. We saw how he looked down on those who were accusing him and said, Lord, forgive them because they are clueless. They do not know what they do. We saw him as he was on the cross. And in that moment, he says, I am thirsty. They gave him a drink. And that's going to be fulfilling certain scriptures we're going to look at again this morning. We saw him when he said, it is finished. And he gave up his last breath. We're going to see that again this morning. We saw him when he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? We saw him when he experienced that separation from God that we also experience. We were born into this world, and you're born into this world being separated from God. And Jesus Christ, who never experienced that in his whole life, because he was the Son of God, at this moment now, while he's on the cross, suddenly comes to this realization, this is what all of mankind experiences. Separation from God. And he cries out at that time, my God, why have you forsaken me? Recognizing I now feel what it is. He experienced everything that you deal with in a very real and pertinent way. So as we get going, what we find in, there's this passage in Mark, and I just want to touch on it as it kind of springboards us into where we're going. So in Mark 15, Jesus is on the cross. Remember how it got dark? There was the earth shook. And it says, and we're going to see it again this morning, that Jesus actually gave up his breath after he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? And then he cries out in this loud voice just before he's about ready to die. He says, it is finished. All that work that needed to be done, all that needed to be accomplished, I have done. I have taken mankind's sin. I took it upon myself. I bore that weight. I died for their sins like those two goats we've talked about. Okay, I was able to, I sacrificed myself for the forgiveness of sins, and now I have taken their sin outside of the temple area. I've taken it out of the city. I am also that scapegoat. I have removed their sin. Remember, we had that cross. We had all these sins listed on it, and we took them down because not only did he forgive you of the sin, but then he took it away. So he did all that work. All that work is done, and he cries out in this loud voice, it is finished. And then it says he gave up his breath. And at that point then, we see this, and this is just wonderful. This is absolutely crazy. And it says in Mark 15, verse 39, it says, and when the centurion, now this is a Roman soldier. He is not a Jew. That is important. We'll touch on that in just a second. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died. Okay, so he saw the darkness. He felt the earth shake. He watched as Jesus forgave the sinner next to him. He watched as Jesus forgave all those who were persecuting him and crucifying him. He watched as he had this interaction with his mother and his beloved disciple. He watched all that, okay? He watched as he cried out, my God, he saw there's some kind of a connection going on here. And then he watched as this guy said, it is finished, and gave up his last breath, and now he's dead. And here's what this Roman soldier has to say. He said, surely this man was the Son of God. Now, keep in mind a couple of things. One is, this is a Roman soldier. He was not raised with any understanding of Jewish history, okay? He wouldn't have known the Jewish laws. All of that, he doesn't know it, okay? There is no prophecy that he has been made aware of in his childhood saying that there's going to be coming this Messiah. That's not in his nature. That's not going on upstairs. And so when you see, he says, surely this man is the Son of God, something that he saw and experienced here has caused him to say, there's something about this man. What's even more mind-blowing, grab this here. In this culture, there was someone that this Roman centurion would have, in a sense, been calling the Son of God up until this point, or calling God, and that would have been Caesar. This Roman soldier, his entire life, would have grown up knowing, you bow your knee to Caesar. Caesar is God. That's all he would have known. That's all he would have been over and over again. That's exactly how he would have been trained. And so something has happened here. And this is remarkable, because to say what this man is saying in public like this, under this Roman law, this is bold of him. Because in a sense, what he's saying is, okay, I grew up knowing that Caesar was God, but now I see this man hanging on the cross and all that's just happened. Surely this guy is the Son of God. And he says it out loud because we have it recorded. And the fact that we have it recorded suggests that there's others who heard it as well. And honestly, he could have lost his job. He could have even lost his life for making such a statement that opposes Caesar in the sense. But yet still here he is in the midst of this, like, wow, surely this guy is the Son of God. And he didn't even have the prophecy. He didn't even have these predictions that we're going to be looking at here this morning and contrasting. And we have them. The Jews had them. So all the more reason, if this Roman centurion can look at Jesus on the cross and say, surely this guy is the Son of God, all the more reason I think we're going to find we should be able to look at that cross and say, wow, you are the Son of God. You are exactly who you said you are. And that's going to lead us to a response. Just like this Roman soldier, when he saw Jesus there, he had to respond. And his response was, this is the Son of God. Up until that point, he had been bowing his knee to Caesar. Now, I think just by verbally saying that, in a sense, he's saying, I'm bowing my knee to this Jesus. We don't know exactly what his life looked like thereafter. However, for him verbalizing that, there was some kind of a change. And we have to at least reflect on this idea of, what in the world are we bowing our knee to? This guy grew up all his life bowing his knee to Caesar. Didn't know any better. Take an honest look at your own life. What is it that you're putting in a position that's higher than Christ? What is it you're bowing your knee to? It could be money. It can be job. It could be your children. You know, my children, I got to do everything that I can for my children. I have to make sure that they're not only protected, but if they want to do this, I have to make sure that I can make that possible for them. Okay? If they want to do this, well, I better make sure that they can do that too, because that's really what they want to do. And we make, in some capacity, be careful with this, we make our children, in a sense, an idol. And they're good kids. We love our kids, you know? But we have to be careful that I don't ever put my children in a place that's above where my knee really belongs to bow, and that's to Christ. At the same moment, just as this centurion, and he wouldn't have known that this was happening, but this is the more evidence that the Jews should have realized there was something significant that took place, and that was the fact that this curtain of the temple was torn into from top to bottom. That's the verse that precedes, just as Jesus died, that precedes what the Roman centurion said. That curtain was torn top to bottom. Now all of a sudden, everything that the Jews had known has been changed. And we're going to look at that this morning. So here's what I want to do as we lead up into what I really want to hit on this morning. I want to kind of bring us up to speed. So there's a number of prophecies. We're looking at this idea of there's these predictions and then there was these fulfillments. And so yeah, on one side, you have what was said in the Old Testament, sometimes New, but mostly Old Testament. This is before Christ came, in some cases, hundreds, if not thousands of years before Jesus Christ came, there was these statements that were made about him. Okay, and now Jesus comes and he fulfills 322 of these prophecies that were about Christ. He fulfills them, and that's crazy. That doesn't happen. And so what ends up, we look at here, so verse by verse, we're going to look at a few of them leading up to this idea of Christ on the cross. And so here's some examples. So for instance, Psalm 41:9. We talked about this a few weeks ago. It says, in Psalm 41:9, it says, "Even my close friend, someone I trusted, one who shared my bread has turned against me." Look at how close that is. This is about David, and David talking about Absalom and how he had betrayed him. And now you have Jesus talking about Judas, and this is a prophetic. It's designed to point to what God's doing with this Messiah. And so in John chapter 13, we find evidence of it. This is sections from verses 21 through 30. It says, "One of you will betray me." Remember, he's in that upper room, Last Supper. And Jesus is troubled in his spirit. He says, "One of you guys is actually going to betray me." And the guys go, like, "What are you, nuts? We would never do that." And they kind of turn to one another, "Who do you think it is?" And he says, "It is whom I give this morsel of bread to." And then he gave it to Judas, one of the 12, the son of Simon Iscariot. After receiving the morsel of bread, he immediately went out. Look at this in Zechariah 11, verse 12. It says, "Then I said to them, if it seems good to you, give me my wages. But if not, keep them. And they weighed out as my wages 30 pieces of silver." This is the prophecy that said what Christ will be sold for, the dollar amount that he would be sold for. Now you look at the fulfillment in Matthew 26, where we find evidence of it. Judas asked, "What are you willing to give me if I deliver him over to you?" And they counted out 30 pieces of silver. Not only that it was going to be a price in 30 pieces of silver, but that money would actually be thrown back into the temple. Look at this. Verse 13 in Zechariah 11 says, "And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter. The lordly price at which I was priced by them. So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them into the house of the Lord." Now that's the temple, house of the Lord. "Threw them into the house of the Lord," that's the temple, "to the potter." And so in Matthew 27, verse 5, we see evidence of it. And this is, again, all leading up to Christ at the cross. This is all that preliminary fulfillment. Specifically, we're going to look today at the prophecies of Christ while he's on the cross. But here we're leading up to it. It says, "So Judas threw the money into the temple and left. Then he went away and hanged himself. The chief priests picked up the coins and decided to use the money to buy the potter's field as a burial place for his foreigners." You see that? More and more piled on evidence that points to there's something about this Jesus. Maybe he's who he says he is. Psalm 69, "Those who hate me without reason outnumber the hairs of my head. Many are my enemies without cause." In other words, we hate him for no reason is what the prophecy is saying. "Those who seek to destroy me." And I'll look at John 15, verse 18 and 25. It says, "If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first." Look at this. "But this is to fulfill what was written in their law. They hated me without reason." It was prophesied hundreds of years before that Jesus would be hated, and there was no reason for him to be hated, and that's exactly what happened. Zechariah 9, verse 9. "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he, humbled and mounted on a donkey," on a colt, the foal of a donkey. Well, how did Jesus Christ enter into Jerusalem? Just like it was prophesied in John 12, verses 14, 15, we find evidence. "Jesus found a young donkey, sat on it. As it is written, do not be afraid, daughter Zion. See, your king is coming seated on a donkey's colt." Now, some may argue, say, well, he had control of that. He could go and decide to ride on a donkey to make it look like he was fulfilling the scriptures. Or you're going to see evidence this morning that that's impossible. And yet, those predictions were true. A couple more. Isaiah 53. And we'll look more at Isaiah 53 in a little bit. So Isaiah 53. If there's ever a passage of scripture that points to Jesus being who he says he is before the Gospels, it's Isaiah 53. So Isaiah 53 says this, "He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not," look at this, "he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth." Look at Luke 23. So he, this would be Herod, plied him with many questions and gave with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. He remained silent. We see more evidence in Matthew 27. Then Pilate said to him, Do you not hear how many things they testify against you? But he gave him no answer, not even to a single charge, so that the governor was greatly amazed. He remained silent. Isaiah 50, it says, I gave my back to those who strike. Remember how he was flogged? Wrapped around a post, and he's tied there. So he gives his back to the flogging. And my cheeks to those who pull out my beard. I hid not my face from disgrace and spitting. And look how it was fulfilled. Mark 10, verse 34. And they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. And after 3 days he will rise. Matthew 26 also points to the event. He says, then they spit in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, prophesy to us, Messiah, who hit you? And finally, Matthew 27, they spit on him, took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. That's all leading up to the cross. All these prophecies that point to this guy is who he says he is, all leading up to the cross. And now what we do is we're going to find Jesus on this cross. And as he's on this cross, we're going to see these prophecies, these things that were predicted come true over and over again. So what we're going to do here is this. We're going to work through the John 19 passage. We're going to finish it up. And then I'm going to show you just a few snippets from Isaiah 53 and Psalm 22. And so we'll kind of talk about it as we go on. But here it is, John 19. So some of this leading up to it, John's giving us this picture. Okay, he wants us to understand something. Because John was there, he witnessed all of it. Remember, he was standing at the foot of the cross. This is nothing new to him. And so as he's witnessed it, he's now expressing this. And we're going to see this again a little bit later on as we go through it. But he's expressing, this is why I'm giving all you all of this information. All of these predictions about Jesus that came true, there's a reason that I'm telling you this. And that's why we're going through it yet this morning. So understand, this is why we're doing it this morning. This is why John did it in the first place. Look at it. Here's what he says. The man who saw it, this is John, has given testimony. And his testimony is true. He knows that he tells the truth. And he testifies so that you may also believe. In other words, I'm telling you all of these predictions and all these things that came true. What's interesting about this gospel of John versus the other gospels really show the humanity of Jesus. John points to the divinity of Jesus more than any of those other gospels. That this Jesus is exactly who he says he is. And who did he say he was? He said he was God. And let me give you the evidence. And that's what we're looking at this morning. So here it is. John 19, verse 16. I know some of this we've already hit. Hang with me. We're going to get to some new stuff here in just a moment. So finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. An interesting note here where it says, so the soldiers took charge of Jesus. A better and more accurate, more literal interpretation would be, and some versions will say it, they led him away. And the fact that they led him away, again, points to Isaiah 53, where it says he was like a lamb led to the slaughter. And so Jesus doesn't go kicking and screaming. He's in a sense, led away. They take him where he does not want to go. And that's all fulfilling the scriptures that we have seen in the Old Testament. So in verse 17, then carrying his own cross, he bore his own cross. He bore the wood for it, just like we talked about a few weeks ago, how Isaac had to carry his own wood to that sacrifice, but there was this supplement sacrifice that God provided. In this case, there will be no supplement. So he went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. Verse 18, there they crucified him, and with him two others, one on each side of Jesus in the middle. We're going to see in Isaiah 53 how he was counted with the wicked. All right, he was with the transgressors. He was with the criminals. It was prophesied that he would die this way, hanging with other criminals. Pilate had a notice prepared and fastened it to the cross. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. We talked about that a little bit ago. Many of the Jews read this sign, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and the sign was written. I love the fact that it was written in all these languages, so no one could miss the fact that Jesus is who he says he is. And it was written in Aramaic, it was written in Latin, it was written in Greek. The chief priests, they didn't care for this. And the Jews, they protested Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but rather that he claimed to be the King of the Jews. And Pilate said, I have written what I have written. Okay, get over it. When the soldiers crucified Jesus, They took his clothes. We're going to see prophesying of this. They took his clothes, dividing them into four shares, each one of them with the undergarment remaining. And this was a seamless undergarment. This was like incredibly high value. Nobody owned something like this. And they just like, well, we can't divide that into four. Let's cast lots to see who actually gets it. So this garment was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. Let's not tear it. It's too valuable to do that, they said. Let's decide by lot as to who will get it. This happened that the scripture might be fulfilled that said, they divided my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment. So this is what the soldiers did. Again, pointing to this fact, all these predictions are coming true. And remember how we talked about Jesus riding on that donkey? Well, maybe he could have controlled that. Perhaps. But could he control this? Hanging on the cross. Hey, guys, say, by the way, if you wouldn't mind, it would really help me out if you actually took my clothes and divided them amongst yourselves, because that would fulfill some prophecy. And then if you would actually, on at least one of those garments, just, you know, cast some lots, because that's going to fit also with Psalm 22. That would help me out a great deal. And remember, these are Roman soldiers. They could care less about the prophecies. They don't care about this Jewish tradition. And so here it is. And they're fulfilling the prophecy that God had laid out 400 plus years ago. And it's all happening. And it shows, okay, if this is all happening, is someone in control of all this? I don't think all that can happen by chance. You ever go to the casino? Mostly if you go to the casino, you're probably not winning lots of money regularly, because the odds are against you. Likewise, for this to all happen by chance, the odds are against it. Near the cross, where Jesus stood, we talked about this a little bit ago too. His mother, his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene, when Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to her, "Woman, here is your son." And to the disciple, "Here is your mother." From that time on, they took care of each other. We're talking about that being that this is that new community. And we're going to see more evidence of that as we wrap this up here this morning. Later, verse 28, knowing that everything had now been finished so that the scripture would be fulfilled, Jesus said, "I am thirsty." It's interesting. We're going to see evidence of this here too. I believe it's in Psalm 69, verse 21, this idea of what they offer him to drink. It actually says in Psalm 69, verse 21, that they will give me vinegar to drink. And that's exactly what they gave him. Okay, Jesus is hanging on the cross. Maybe they offered him water. Maybe they offered him some grape juice. No, you guys, actually what I prefer is vinegar, because that would kind of point to that I am who I say I am. And that's not happening. So a jar of wine vinegar was there, so they soaked a sponge in it, put the sponge on a stalk of hyssop. I've talked about that too. He has no control over what they're going to do. And the hyssop is that same branch that was used to spread over the doorpost, the blood, during the Passover. I mean, over and over again. I mean, do you see this? Like, this is impossible. This can't happen. And yet it's happening. And they lifted it up to Jesus' lips. When he'd received the drink, Jesus said, "It is finished." And with that, he bowed his head. I love this. And he gave up his spirit. Okay, that's so significant, because who killed him? Yeah, we could say, okay, the Jews killed him, the Romans killed him. But there's something going on here. It's said before in the Gospel of John. He says, nobody takes my life. Remember John 10. But instead, what I do is I give my life, okay? I give it up on my own accord. Nobody takes it from me. And then I will also raise it up. This is the point. John's making this very clear to us. Understand, Jesus gave up his life. He hadn't been on the cross very long. There was really no reason for him to die that quickly. He gave it up. He gave up his spirit because all the work had been done. I don't need to stay here. You know, remember when they were mocking him? He's hanging on the cross and they're mocking him. If you're really the Messiah, take yourself down. Okay, I'll take myself down when it's time. And in a way, he did. Because all that the work had been done, now it's time. I've done the work that I need to do, and he gave up his spirit at his choosing. It's crazy. Why am I not working anymore? Help. There. Now, this is interesting, because this is new passages we haven't looked at yet. So look at this. So now it was the day of preparation. And the next day was to be a special Sabbath. This is Passover. So this Sabbath at Passover, this is like the Easter Sunday, if you will. Okay? You know how on Easter Sunday we all kind of step up our dress? You know what I'm saying? Okay, we all go buy new shirts. We get maybe new pants, new dress, whatever the case is. Some of us wear Easter bonnets. But we go to church in this idea, we bring the A game, if you will, come Easter Sunday. And that's in a sense what's going on here. This is a preparation. We have to be ready for ceremonial washing, all this stuff, because Easter Sunday is coming, if you will. This is Passover Sabbath. That's a big deal. All right, so Passover Sabbath is coming because the Jewish leaders did not want the bodies out there. Hey, this is Easter Sunday. We don't want these bodies hanging out outside the temple. That's just gross, okay? So we'd really like you to finish the job, knock out their legs so that they have broken legs. They can't push themselves up to breathe anymore. So they'll be all slumped down. They'll be basically suffocate much quicker, okay? So Pilate, if you do us a favor, knock out their legs, break them so that they will die more quickly. Because we don't want those up there. So they asked Pilate to have the legs broken and the bodies taken down. The soldiers, therefore, came and broke the legs of the first man who had been crucified with Jesus and then to the other. So both criminals had their legs broken. All right, and so they would just basically, the guy's hanging on the cross, he's down there supporting himself up. They come with a big hammer and quack. It's unfortunate. But when they come to Jesus, they find that Jesus is already dead, which is a little bit astounding to them. But when they came to Jesus, they found that he was already dead and they did not break his legs. And again, this is pointing to scripture and we'll see that. Just remarkable. Did Jesus have control? He's already dead. Did he have control over whether they're going to break his legs or not? Not physically. Isn't that something? And yet the prediction happened just the way it was predicted to happen. Instead, one of the soldiers pierced his side, also fulfilling scripture, with a spear, bringing a sudden flow of blood and water. The man who saw it has given testimony. This is John again. We saw this passage before. Has given testimony, and his testimony is true. In other words, John is saying, I saw all of this happen. Every part of this I am testifying to. He knows that he tells the truth, and he testifies to it. Why am I telling you all this stuff? Because I want you guys to understand that this is true, that Jesus is exactly who he says he is, and now he's who I say he is because I'm saying it. He's who he says he is. Did you catch that? These things happen so that the scripture would be fulfilled. Not one of his bones will be broken. And remember, Jesus didn't make that happen. He's already dead. But yet the power of God did, and Jesus is God. Not one of his bones will be broken. And as another scripture says, and they will look on the one that they have pierced. Later, and this is so good too here. Later, Joseph of Arimathea. Joseph was part of the Sanhedrin. Same with Nicodemus. Look at these two guys. It's wonderful. So Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Okay? So Joseph goes and asks Pilate. That's public. But now Joseph was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly, because he feared the Jewish leaders. Remember way back in John chapter 12, where we had all these Jewish leaders in Sanhedrin, they say, we got to kill this guy. We got to get him. We got to get Lazarus. We got to get him out of here. And it said that there was these guys that, in a sense, secretly followed Jesus, but no one said anything. Because why? Because they loved the admiration of men more than God. In other words, they feared men more than they feared God. I think that's over. I think that's come to an end. Because here's Joseph of Arimathea, a member of the Sanhedrin, going publicly to Pilate. He doesn't care who sees him anymore. We'll see more evidence than this in a second. And so he goes to Pilate and says, I want Jesus' body. Okay, give me his body so I can give him a proper burial. So he was accompanied by Nicodemus. That's another member of the Sanhedrin. Nicodemus, he's the one that went to him at night. It says so. The man who earlier had visited Jesus at night. Nicodemus brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds. So here's Nicodemus carrying 75 pounds of spices and aloe and stuff. Jesus is dead. It's like, hey, Nicodemus, where are you going with that? I'm going to go prepare Jesus' body for burial. There's no secret anymore. These guys are no longer following Christ in secret. They're done with that. Recognizing that Jesus is who he said he is has changed them, has changed their behavior. And likewise, I think it should change our behavior. And that's incredible. So here they are in public, out in the open, with all the Jewish leaders, knowing full well that these guys are not only part of the Sanhedrin, but they're like, wow, these guys are following Christ. This is not what I expected. Verse 40, taking Jesus' body, the two of them wrapped it with the spices and strips of linen. This was in accordance with the Jewish burial customs. So here they are. They've got Jesus' body, just the two of them. And I don't know the sequence, but they're probably pouring out layer and layer as they wrap it. They wrap another layer, and they wrap them again. All of this, preparing Christ for burial in a very honoring and respectful way. At the place where Jesus was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had ever been laid. This is important. Joseph of Arimathea was a rich man. And so he burying him in his own tomb. And what we're going to see here in a moment, in Isaiah 53, it talks about how Jesus Christ was basically aligned with the transgressors. He was considered a sinner. And yet it also then says, but he was buried with the rich. And what's even more important is, here's Jesus. He's put in a brand new tomb. You know what that means? No one's been in that tomb before. I know, that seemed a little bit like obvious, like duh. But there's such significance that that's really what's going on is Jesus is buried into a new tomb. Because what would happen is if you had a tomb as a family, all the members of your family would be buried, in a sense, in that tomb. And so really what's going on here is it's being, John is pointing out, Jesus has begun something new. That whole community thing that he brought in his mom and John in on, I'm starting a new community. This is more evidence that I'm starting a new community because he was put in a brand new tomb. There's no family else there. Anyone now that's buried into this tomb is buried with Christ, like the baptism we had just 2 weeks ago. Isn't that something? Just something. And final verse. And I love this. Because it was the Jewish day of preparation, and since the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. This is important. Remember, we talked about this whole idea. This is the special, this Easter Sunday. Because of what Joseph of Arimathea did and what Nicodemus did in preparing Jesus' body for burial, you know what that meant? They could not participate in that special Sabbath because they had touched a dead body. They were not allowed. There's no ceremonial cleansing that would have prepared them quick enough to be able to participate in that. And so publicly what they were doing is like, I don't care. You can have your Easter Sunday. I got something bigger going on right now. You can have your special Sabbath. There's something bigger going on right now. This was the Son of God. He's dead, and we are burying him. We're giving him a proper burial because I believe that he was who he says he is. And so they sacrifice all that would have been kind of esteemed in public for their own behalf and say, I don't care about being esteemed publicly anymore. I care more that he is honored because he is who he says he is. And here's the evidence. Isaiah 53. I only have select verses. We'll be done in a moment. So Isaiah 53, I mentioned that this is one of the strongest passages that we have in all Scripture because it's really, it's laid out from top to bottom, all pointing to this Jesus guy. So if you look at this, now we just covered a lot with Jesus on the cross. Now, thinking of what we've just talked about from this week and weeks prior, you tell me that as we read this, that this doesn't point to who this Jesus is. So this is what it says. He was despised, we talked about that, and rejected, we talked about that, by mankind. A man of suffering and familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised and we held him in low esteem. Does that fit? That seems to fit. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, and yet we considered him punished by God. I love that. Okay, remember we talked about this a few weeks ago. Why was it so important that Jesus was crucified? Because by Jesus being crucified, we find in Leviticus, we find in that Old Testament, that the only reason that someone would be crucified or why they wanted to be crucified, because if you were hanging on a pole, it said that you were considered to be cursed by God. Anyone hung on a pole was considered to be cursed by God. And the Jewish leaders wanted it to appear, Jesus, we have to show that he was cursed by God, that he is not who he says he is. And yet this is what it points to in Isaiah 53, hundreds of years before. It says, yet we considered him to be punished by God. We considered him to be cursed by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. We talked about that a little bit ago. Again, more and more evidence. What in the world? How can these things happen? He couldn't control the piercing. And yet there it is, reflecting back on Isaiah 53, that this Jesus is who he says he is. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. A few weeks ago, we talked about he's taken on our sin. Verse 7, he was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. We already looked at that. He was led. Remember, we talked about that in verse 16. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter. And as a sheep before his shearers is silent, he did not open his mouth. Verse 8, by oppression and judgment he was taken away. Yet, who of his generation protested? Even his own people said, crucify him. For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was punished. He was assigned a grave with the wicked, and with the rich in his death. You see that? He was a sign in a sense, okay, here he is hanging on the cross. He got wicked men on both sides. And yet, even in the midst of that, so he can relate to the wicked. Are you wicked? Probably more wicked than we'd like to admit. Let's be honest. So he can relate to us because we're wicked. Because he hung with the wicked. He was considered to be wicked. And yet, he was with the rich. He can relate to the rich. He can relate to the poor. He can relate to the wicked. He can relate to the righteous, if you will. This Jesus Christ is who he says he is, and he's for all people. Even the fact that this Roman centurion, at the point of Jesus' death, that's the first recorded statement we have. At the point of Jesus' death, the Roman is the first one to say something and says, sure, this man was the Son of God. Already, boom, right at that point, already the gospel is penetrating the Gentiles. You see that? Wow. Though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth, yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life an offering for sin, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After he has suffered like this, we already looked at this, what Jesus prophesied in Mark 10 says, in 3 days I will rise again. He says, after he has suffered, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. And by his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors, for he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. That's Isaiah 53. Short a couple of verses in the beginning and the end. Does that point to someone? Oh, it better. And yet the Jews missed it. Let's not miss it. The Roman centurion didn't even have that, and he didn't miss it. Just a few verses in Psalm 22. Look at this. My God, why have you forsaken me? Quoted by Christ on the cross. Verse 7. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads, pointing to Jesus Christ on the cross. I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. So when they were crucified, hanging there, literally, his bones would have been like dislocated. Again, pointing to this Jesus, that he is who he says he is. Did Jesus have control that all of his joints would be out of place? No. But God did. My mouth is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. Remember when he says, I am thirsty. A pack of villains encircle me. They pierce my hands and my feet. So who are we talking about? Well, let's see. Let's think about this. Who did this happen that actually looks like? Well, it's Jesus. Actually, all these things happened to Jesus. All my bones are on display. Likely, when they did the cat of nine tails, when they did the flogging, literally the way that they did these, he would have had bones exposed. Okay, you ever get cut like bad and you think, well, it was cut down to my bone? For some of you, maybe that happened. For most of you, it didn't happen and you're exaggerating the reality. Okay, so if you have a young boy, 6 years old, I got cut real deep. Look, I can see the bone. That's not your bone. That's just the fat tissue underneath. Okay, yes, it's deep. We should get it stitched, but is it your bone? No, deal with it. Butterfly bandages can do wonders. A little bit of scarring, but scars make you the man that you are. All my bones are on display. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my clothes among them, and they cast lots for my garment. Remember that song? The guys, it really helped me out. Remarkable when we look at all the prophecy. We just hit a handful. Let's be honest. We don't have time for 322. There's 322 prophecies that point to this Jesus is exactly who he says he is. So this is kind of how I want to wrap up and conclude. There's a truth that we look at and we see this Roman centurion. He's standing there. He doesn't know all of these prophecies that we've already talked about. But he's standing there looking up at Christ at the cross. He's experienced all these things, just like John did. He was there. Now, John had a little bit of that depth, and John knew the Jewish history, but this Roman centurion did not. And so here he stands there looking at this guy, and something clicks, and he recognizes this man is who he says he is. And that right there must lead to a response. Will I continue then to bow my knee to Caesar? Or have I just recognized that there's something bigger going on? And now it's time to bow my knee where it belongs. So here we have on the cross, we've just looked at all of these prophecies that point to Jesus Christ is exactly who he says he is. And now we're faced with the same decision that the Roman centurion was. What will we do with it? Well, we recognize, Jesus, you are who you say you are, and that's got to lead me to change. It's got to affect me. I have to be different because of you are who you say you are. I can't keep living this life the way that I've always lived it. No matter how righteous you might be, how righteous you might think you are, it has to lead to change. And so here we are faced with the decision again. Christ is on the cross. He is exactly who he says he is. Where will my knee bow? He'll be saying, no. Sorry, maybe sometime, but I gotta stick with what I know. I gotta stick with the job. I gotta stick with the family. Or are you gonna allow this Christ, who is who he says he is, to change your life? Let me just kind of wrap it up with this idea. I don't know what struggles you have in your life. I think for many of us, financial is probably a reality. I think struggles with loved ones, whether we're having conflict with loved ones, maybe it's work staff, whatever the case is. We've got a lot of stuff going on that kind of can oppress us, that can kind of push us down. Maybe it's people that are just critical to us. Maybe it's relationship with an offspring. Maybe it's relationship with a spouse, whatever the case is. But we look at this idea and we get overwhelmed with all that I have to deal with. I can't handle this. I can't handle this. I can't handle this. And you're right, you probably can't. However, let's look at this picture of Christ on the cross and let's understand, okay, he's hanging on the cross. He can't physically control what these people do to him, and yet he's in control. He is in total control of everything that's going to happen. So if Jesus Christ can be in control before he reaches the cross, if he can be in control once he's on the cross to continue this work that he's begun, if he can be in control even after he's dead and all of these things that were prophesied continue to happen, if he can have that kind of control, that kind of power, can we not trust a God with that kind of control? Take the things that are stressing us out in our lives. And I think we can. And that's where our knee then turns. And instead of bowing to someone else, I come down and I face the cross. It's like, oh, okay, now I get it. And I'll bow. Because what I thought was important isn't as much. Because you controlled all those other things? Okay. I'll trust you in this. So I'm going to invite Lane and the worship team to come, and we're going to worship. And I just want you to, I want you to sing, I want you to worship, I want you to pray and reflect, but challenge yourself with this reality. If Jesus is who he says he is, it's got to cause me to change. If Jesus is who he says he is, he's got all these controls. If he did all of those things and they were fulfilled, he did some of them even while he was dead. If he's got that kind of control, then he can handle what I've got going on. And I can bow my knee before him because it's like, okay, I'll bow to you because you can handle what I got going on.